Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. Hope you're having a great weekend. Happy Saturday. You're listening to Ron Brooks Show. And today we're going to devote the show to the murder of the Washington Post columnist Khashoggi. Khashoggi, or whatever. I don't know how to pronounce his name. I'm not going to even try. I'll say Khashoggi and whatever. I think this is actually quite a fascinating topic because it is incredibly revealing. It's incredibly revealing of the complete and utter bankruptcy of both the left and the right. This issue is being dealt with by the New York Times, the Washington Post, Breitbart, and the New York Post, and on the right, and kind of the Trump administration, and Republicans and Democrats in Congress, and nobody gets it right, and nobody seems to care, and it doesn't really matter. It's just more of an illustration, more than anything else, of the complete bankruptcy and the complete incompetence of our entire, political class, media class. It's like they don't know what to do with this. And you're not getting the full story from either side. You're not getting the full story. You're certainly not getting any context, history, suggestion. Now you can piece it together if you read a bunch of different things from different places, and if you read both the left and the right and everything else, and you put it together. But there's no context. The general consensus is there's nothing much that can be done. Trump's attitude is, oh, we can't do anything because there's a $100 million arms deal on the table, and we don't want them. We don't want to lose jobs. You know, the ultimate in short-term pragmatism. The left's response is, oh, we need sanctions on Saudi Arabia immediately. We need sanctions. This is horrific. From the same people who told us that sanctions never work in Iran or anywhere else, and they don't work in the Middle East, and we shouldn't have sanctions in the Middle East. And now suddenly they all want sanctions. So, to really do this topic justice and to put in perspective the killing, one has to really look at history, and one has to really analyze properly to analyze properly kind of the history of U.S.-Saudi relations, the history of the Saudi Arabia, what Saudi Arabia represents, who was this guy Khashoggi, what does he represent? Is the media representing him the way he really was? Is it misrepresenting him? Is Donald Trump? And what does it mean that we're going to ignore anything the Saudis do because there's a $100 million arms deal on the table? What kind of attitude towards foreign policy does that represent? So, so that's what I want to cover. Some of this will be overlap with some of the stuff I've covered in my History of the Middle East course, which you should all be taking. It's available for free on both iTunes as a podcast and audio only, also on YouTube in my channel. Go to, I think it's under courses in my playlists. Also, the history of Islamic totalitarianism, which also covers some of the material associated with Saudi Arabia and U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia, is covered there, and you can get that, again, in the same places, all for free. And you really should. If you're interested in the Middle East, if you're interested in Islam, if you're interested in Islamic terrorism, then these maybe not are the best sources of information about it, but they certainly are the most condensed best sources about it. So as a short version, I don't know of anything better where you can catch up on what's going on. Of course, you should also read Winning the Unwinnable War and a lot of Ilan Jono's work on this topic. So first, Saudi Arabia just killed a Washington Post columnist. There's no question. They brutally murdered him. It was premeditated. There seems to be strong evidence about this. And in addition to that, he was a Saudi national. He was visiting the embassy. They did it inside the embassy, but on Turkish soil. And then they denied it, and now they've admitted it, but now they say it was a fight. So, you know, who knows the stories. And some people say, who cares? Saudis killing Saudis doesn't matter. Other people say, yeah, but he was a journalist for the Washington Post, and this is journalists. What do we do with this? And how do we put this into the context of Saudi Arabia regime killing opposition figures left and right, jailing them, whipping them, I mean, literally whipping them, lashes. Saudi Arabia imprisoning female activists, even though they allowed women to drive at about the same time, they basically put in jail all the women who had actively promoted female driving, and they put them on a jail. Does that matter? Is this more important? Again, no perspective. What do we do with the fact that, you know, Facebook, young people on Facebook, if they say they're atheists, or if they say they oppose the king, or they oppose Islam, or anything like that, get sent to jail and again are whipped? And what about the stoning of adulteresses? How do we take that into account? I mean, the bottom line in much of this debate, which nobody will say, not on the left and not on the right. And the left, of course, is completely hypocritical, because suddenly they're the biggest critics of Saudi Arabia ever, even though Obama was a Saudi's best friend, just like Bush was, just like Trump is. There's no difference in foreign policy here. But the left is suddenly tough on Saudi Arabia. I mean, give me a break. Saudi Arabia is a barbaric, primitive regime. It is a kingdom when kingdoms should have disappeared from the face of the earth 200 years ago. It's not just a kingdom as a symbolic kingdom. It's an authoritarian, totalitarian state with a king at the head of it. That's what Saudi Arabia is. It's a barbaric, uncivilized place, a barbaric, uncivilized people who behave like monsters towards their own people and have no problem killing people anywhere, everywhere, if it suits their purposes. And if they don't think, they will suffer from it. And the idea that Saudi Arabia has moderated under the latest Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, which I was hopeful about, but skeptical always, has turned out to be a complete absurdity. MBS, as he is called, is as BS as all the other royal family members. And yes, he is slightly more moderate, but much more authoritarian and totalitarian. He has jailed his critics. He has killed princesses, cousins, I guess, half cousins. I don't know how you calculate this in Saudi Arabia when you have harems, when you have many mothers. I guess many fathers. I don't know. I don't know how that works. You have many wives. I mean, give me a break. This is the 21st century. We take a regime like this seriously? I mean, one of my first criticisms of Donald Trump, and one of the images that unfortunately has scarred my brain, is Donald Trump dancing in Saudi Arabia with the barbaric princes of that totalitarian regime. We support them with weapons. We support them with diplomatic cover. We treat them as a civilized country integrated into our world, as moderates that are allies. Everybody says, everywhere I read, oh, but Saudi Arabia is an ally. That's what the right says. And the left said the same thing when they were in power. Saudi Arabia is an ally. At least admit, if you're afraid what will happen to oil prices, if you get tough with Saudi Arabia, at least admit that. Don't. But really? They're an ally? All right, now I know there's some Super Chat questions, but if they're not related to this topic, I'm going to leave them to the end. So only ask questions related to the topic if you want the answer now. Otherwise, they're going to have to be at the end. Now, there's a lot of history here, and I'm not going to bore you with a whole bunch of history. And I want to keep this relevant and updated and relevant to what's going on today. But we have to start from the premise. Saudi Arabia is not only two premises. One, Saudi Arabia is a barbaric, authoritarian, primitive regime that is fundamentally opposed in every fiber of its existence to Western values and ideas. One. Two, Saudi Arabia has, for the last, certainly since 1979, has been the world's largest or second largest, depending on how you calculate it, depending on the stats you have, funder of radicalization, of terrorism, of radicalization in the name of Islam in the world. It competes regularly for the number one slot with Iran. So one, barbaric. Two, massive, constant funder of terrorism. And not just of terrorism itself, but it funds the mosques, the madrasas, the schools, the activities of organizations all over the world dedicated to the Islamization of Europe, the Islamization of the world, the Islamization of, yeah, bringing Sharia to the world in one form or another, either peacefully or through military response. We'll get in a minute to Saudi Arabia's attitude towards the Muslim Brotherhood and Khashoggi's relationship with the Muslim Brotherhood, which is all really, really interesting. Saudi is no friend of America. It is no friend of Israel. It is no friend of anything Western. It might be your ally today while it is funding, stabbing you in the back tomorrow. For those of you who know, that is a legitimate tactic on the Islam to form alliances that meet your short-term needs while recognizing the fact that the alliance is still with an enemy that you will take care of when the time comes. And that's exactly what Saudi Arabia did. Now, what is the history? The history goes back to the 18th century when the Saud family, a warring tribe, was trying to take over the Saudi Peninsula, was trying to dominate the other tribes in the area. And, you know, they were struggling to do this, and they teamed up with a group of fundamentalist clergymen, mullahs, who practiced something called Wahhabism. They teamed up with Wahhabi, the originator of Wahhabism. And Wahhabi preached something very simple. He preached that the decline in Islam, the decline of the Muslim world, was caused by one thing really only, and that was the fact that Muslims had moved away from the true religion, moved away from sticking to the Quran and living by Sharia law. Right? And they teamed up under this understanding. The Saud family, once it became king of the entire peninsula, would leave the spiritual world to the Wahhabis. They would leave them to preach what they wanted. They would leave them to teach what they wanted. And not only would they leave them, they would provide them with protection and with funding. Wahhabis would be in the future Saudi state, if you could call it a state. They would be responsible for the spiritual life. On the other hand, the Wahhabis would then never challenge the Saud family's political dominance over the territory. If you will, to use Ayn Rand's terminology from a famous essay she wrote for The New Intellectual, which I recommend to everybody, it's in a little book called For the New Intellectual, the Saudis would be Attila, the Saud family would be Attila, and the Wahhabis would be the witch doctors. And it succeeded. The family took over the entire peninsula, you know, and dominated that part of the Middle East for decades to come, and really into the 20th century, ultimately cutting a deal with the British to post-World War I, once the Ottoman Empire was kind of split up to define their territory. And that is what you have, the modern-day Saudi Arabia is the territory granted to them by the deal that was made post-World War I between the British and French and the victorious parties. Okay. So that is how Saudi Arabia came to being. It has always been spiritually, religiously in the hands of people who believe that Islam should be practiced by the book. It is always being spiritually ruled by fundamentalists, by people who have a particular interpretation of Sharia law. That interpretation has got them to stone women who commit adultery. That interpretation has gotten them to, to cut off the hand of thieves because they stole, a hand for a hand, an eye for an eye, and they practice all of this. And it is, as I said, that is the interpretation that is caused them to remain barbaric, even on the scale of other Middle Eastern countries. Saudi Arabia is barbaric, uneducated, primitive, unless you're in the royal family and you got educated in the West, as many people do, or Khashoggi, who got educated in the University of Indiana. The educational system is horrible. The culture is a horrible, primitive, barbaric culture. So that brings us, I guess, all the way to World War II. Pre-World War II, the Saudis discover, or American companies, British companies discover oil in Saudi Arabia. American companies join them. American, French, British companies all start drilling in Saudi Arabia. They have a deal with the king to drill in Saudi Arabia, and they discover not only plentiful oil, but what makes Saudi oil unique relative to fracking, unique relative to Venezuela, which has more oil reserves than Saudi Arabia, unique really across the board. What makes their oil unique is that it's so easy to get. It's so cheap to get that oil. The oil is relatively shallow. It's relatively high quality. So what you get in Saudi Arabia is cheap oil, and of course, all the political power and all the economic influence that comes from that, particularly when in the 1950s and in the 1960s, the Saudis basically nationalized all the oil that was discovered by these French and British and American companies. And it is nationalized and basically taken over by the royal family. They create their own oil company, which now there is talk about, there has been talk, I think it's been taken off the table, but there has been talk about the Saudi oil company, the national oil company going public, the whole idea of it going public, it wasn't really owned by the state in a sense of the way we think of a state. It's owned by the royal family. It's owned by a king. A king owns the Saudi royal family, all the oil. And when they go take it public and they take cash out of it by selling shares to the public, the king gets richer. It's not the people. It's not shareholders. There are no shareholders. It's the royal family of the shareholders. The king gets richer. Another aspect of the complete barbarism of that regime. And there was a lot of talk about taking oil public. They didn't, I think, primarily because they couldn't really tolerate the kind of governance requirements that would be required if they listed in a place like London or New York, which were the places they were considering listing the companies. I think they came to realize that they would lose some control, that they would have to abide by some British financial regulations and American financial regulations, and that they would not tolerate. They would just not tolerate. So what has really made Saudi Arabia important is oil, because other than oil, it's a bunch of Muslims living in the desert that do nothing, produce nothing, create nothing. That's it. What makes Saudi Arabia important is the oil. Now, note that what makes Saudi Arabia have so much influence is the control they have over the oil. And the control they have over the oil is a consequence of the fact that the West, the United States, France, Britain, sat quietly on the sideline as Iran, then Saudi Arabia, and the rest of the Arab world nationalized all the assets created by Western companies, Western capital, Western money. It may be the most evident example of this is in 1956, when the Egyptians basically took the Suez Canal, which was owned privately by an investment consortium of French and Brits, of English and English, and they took it by force. Unbelievable, but the French and the British actually parachuted troops into the Suez Canal to protect their property rights. And Eisenhower, by the way, supported by Israel that invaded the Sinai Desert and took Sinai. And then Eisenhower forced them all to retract and basically handed the Suez Canal to Nasser, the dictator of Egypt. And as a consequence, following that, all foreign assets, all U.S., British, and French assets were confiscated in the Middle East. And as a consequence, these Arabs who have no particular skills, no particular ability, basically stole the wealth that was created by the West. And it became a major financier of all kinds of things, including of terror, and have become able to buy $100 billion worth of weapons that Donald Trump does not want to give up, because they're jobs, American jobs. We can't do a foreign policy because there are American jobs at stake. Let's give weapons to our worst enemies because there are American jobs at stake. Unbelievable. Anyway, the Saudis originally were not very interested in terrorism. I mean, they funded terrorist groups like the PLO. They funded other terrorist groups around the Middle East. Anything to go after those Jews, anything to go after the West. But generally, they were pretty happy with the money flowing in. Most of the princes vacationed in Monaco and went to Europe to do the things that were not allowed to do in Saudi Arabia, to drink, to have sex, to gamble, to do things like that. And there seems to be some equilibrium. You know, during the 1973 war, they placed an embargo on the West in terms of oil, and the West just went apoplectic and went crazy. And that just reinforced the Saudis, ooh, we have real power. We can use this real power. And then in 1979, as everything was cruising along in Saudi Arabia, and they were actually doing some reforms and loosening up, and they were kind of weakening a little bit the influence of the Wahhabis and kind of pretending to be more friendly, all the while just raking in the dollars and living the high life. They needed to do all that other stuff in order to keep their critics at bay and be able to live the kind of life these Saudi princes live. In 1979, a group of jihadists, I think it was Mecca, taking over the Grand Mosque, killing, I can't remember how many people, lots and lots of people. And it required a special forces team comprised of the Saudis and the French, but primarily the French, to go into the mosque and kill the jihadis. The Saudis were apoplectic. They were in major panic mode. This is right after the takeover of the U.S. embassy by the Iranians in 1979. And it was just that the Saudis didn't know what to do. Suddenly, really for the first time in their history, there was a violent, militant opposition to what they were doing. And there was real opposition to the corruption and decay and the fact that all these Saudi princesses were going to Europe and playing around and doing all this stuff. And that the people in Saudi Arabia were upset because there wasn't like a dedication to the real religion that they used to be. And suddenly there was real opposition to the Saudis on the right, if you will, or on the religious fundamentalist axis. And the Saudis needed to figure out what to do. They could, on the one hand, declare themselves to be more liberal, right, and tell the jihadists to go to hell. But there's no way, there's no basis for them to do that. They claimed a mantle of jihad. They claimed a mantle of Islamism. They couldn't negate what the terrorists were trying to do. So what they did was a mea culpa. They said, you're right, we made a mistake. We have not been pure enough. We have not been conservative enough. We have not been fundamentalist enough. And while the princes didn't really change their behavior anymore, what they did do is, one, they started camping down on all liberal opposition, liberal in the positive sense, within Saudi Arabia, and destroying it. They started becoming much more conservative in terms of women, in terms of punishment in the judiciary, in the courts, much more dedicated to Sharia. And at the same time, they started dedicating huge amounts of money to take over the jihadi movement. And maybe the most powerful way in which they did that is they started funding aggressively Bin Laden and the rest of the jihadi movement's attempt to kick the Russians out of Afghanistan. And they did that from 79 through the 1980s. Saudi Arabia was the number one funder. But in addition to that, at the same time, they were funded madrasas in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, all over the Middle East. They were heavy, heavy funders of the Muslim Brotherhood. We'll get to the Muslim Brotherhood in a minute. All over the Middle East, in Jordan, in Morocco, in Algeria, they were funding the uprising in Algeria. They, throughout this period of the 80s and the 90s, the Saudis funded every terrorist organization on the Sunni side. They funded and supported many terrorist organizations on the Shiite side if they were consistent with like attacking Israel. They funded terrorist groups in Indonesia and Malaysia and madrasas and the attempt to radicalize Islam in Europe and in America. They sent their preachers all over the world to try to establish mosques of radical jihadists. This is Saudi Arabia. Now, again, the only competition they had for this was Iran, who in November 1st, 1979, took over the embassy, established ultimately Ayatollah Khomeini as the supreme leader, and started funding terrorism, madrasas, and everything else on the Iranian side. So you had both competition for funds for the jihadis. So there's something new here. Suddenly, we've discovered Saudi Arabia's the bad guys, the left says. And the right says, oh no, they've never been bad guys. Let's sell them $100 billion more of weapons because they're such nice guys. They've always been nice guys. They're our ally. Ally? Funding terrorism against us, an ally? Really? Hey, so here we are. With this murder, right? So let's finish kind of update the story. So we have this radicalization. It really went through 9/11 and it continued after 9/11 because one of the lessons the Saudis learned from 9/11 is that America is pathetic. America won't do anything about this. So they needed to continue to buy out the radicals, particularly given that the radicals were again trying to target the Saudis. The Saudis also became much more worried about Iranian expansionism, particularly with Barack Obama's presidency, where it became clear that America would not stop Iranian ambitions across the Middle East. So the Saudis would have to try to do it themselves. In that sense, the Saudis allied themselves somewhat with the Israelis in order to combat the growing influence of Iran. But the Iranians and Saudis have basically the same goal, the destruction of the West and the imposition of Sharia law. One wants to do it Sunni way, wants to do it Shiite way, and obviously they have a different time frame and they have different motivations and different incentives. But there's no fundamental difference between the two from a Westernized perspective. They are both equally evil. So, about a couple of years ago, the Saudis came to the realization, before Trump was elected, the later days of the Obama administration, that if they continue to fund these radicals will turn on them. If they continue to fund these radicals, they would have a hard time fighting the Iranians because the radicals didn't really want to fight the Iranians. The radicals wanted to team up with the Iranians. The Saudis also saw what happened to ISIS, and they viewed ISIS as an existential threat. while they were, they created ISIS to a large extent, while money from Saudi Arabia funded ISIS, the regime in Saudi Arabia was very afraid of ISIS, that ISIS would spread. And again, they saw both Obama administration and the Trump administration's really impotence in dealing with the ISIS threats. And Saudi Arabia believed that they had to deal with it themselves. And to do that, they believed they had to become less fundamentalists. And that is MBS's agenda. He wants to be, so wants to be Sharia law and all that, but less fundamentalist. Also, in terms of decision making, they needed to centralize it. So up until recently, decisions in the Saudi royal family had to by a committee of princesses. MBS decided that he was going to take control, that he would be the only decision maker, that the real threat was Iran, that they would that he would stop funding. Not fund as much of the radicalization among the Sunnis, but that he would instead spend the money on fighting Iranians wherever he could, which is why they were in Yemen and everywhere else. And in that context, he was even willing to ally himself with the Israelis. There's also another point that I have to make here, and this relates again to the Khashoggi, the response to the Khashoggi murder. One of the things that scared the Saudi regime really badly was the Arab Spring. Up until the Arab Spring, the Saudi regime had always been incredibly friendly to the Muslim Brotherhood. After all, their goals are similar. The establishment of a Sunni caliphate led by Sharia law. And there might be different tactics. Saudis don't really have a tactic to achieve that other than to fund the promotion of these ideas. The Muslim Brotherhood thought they could do it through education and ultimately through election and ultimately, you know, through taking over the government, maybe even through elections. So the Saudi government supported the Muslim Brotherhood in that. It even goes back to the 1950s and 60s when Egypt under Nasser tried to expel Said Qutb was one of the people they hung, but they either killed them or expelled all the Muslim Brotherhood leaders. The place where all these Muslim Brotherhood leaders actually found refuge was in Saudi Arabia. And indeed, one of Osama bin Laden's teachers at university in Saudi Arabia was Said Qutb. Said Qutb was a big-time anti-Western, anti-American Muslim Brotherhood intellectual in Egypt. His brother was actually one of bin Laden's teachers, So Muslim Brotherhood, and then in the 1980s, after Sadat was murdered, when Mubarak expelled the Muslim Brotherhood from Egypt again they went to Saudi Arabia and they became teachers and so-called intellectuals in Saudi Arabia. So Saudi Arabia has always had a positive, friendly view of the Muslim Brotherhood. Until the Arab Spring. The problem with the Arab Spring is the Muslim Brotherhood got too powerful for the Saudis. Remember, the Saudis, the royal family, doesn't really believe in anything except the power of the royal family. They don't really care about Islam that much. They support the Muslim cause because that, they believe, holds their opponents at bay. Did video just go out? Did audio just go out? Anybody on Facebook or YouTube, can you just give me a thumbs up that video is still working, audio is still working? Oh, is my whole computer frozen? Wow, that is weird. Sorry about this. I don't know if you can hear me, but... let's see. My computer has frozen, and I don't know why. That is weird. Okay, give me a second. One, two, three. Anybody there? Damn it. Unbelievable. All right, I'm going to continue because I think the audio is still working, and I will edit out some of this. And I see the video is frozen on Facebook and on YouTube. So I apologize, no video. Hopefully it'll come back. I'm not sure exactly what's going on with my computer. This shouldn't happen. There's enough computing power here to compute whatever, and I'm not doing that much. But, you know, there we go. We have what we have. Okay, let me finish up. What happened is during the Arab Spring is that the Muslim Brotherhood realized, the Saudi Arabia, the princes realized that the Muslim Brotherhood was incredibly powerful, that the Muslim Brotherhood indeed was so powerful that they posed, again, a threat to the Saudi regime. They had won the elections in Egypt and were taking over. They had won elections in other places. They were part of governments in Morocco and Jordan and other places, and they were really the new force on the Islamist side of the Middle East. And this really, really, really worried the Saudis. Would the Muslim Brotherhood rise in Saudi Arabia and overthrow them? Again, not for ideological reasons, there's no big ideological difference between the two, but for purely issues related to power. There was real concern on behalf of the Saudi princes about their ability to sustain their influence, to sustain their power. So they have turned massively anti-Muslim Brotherhood since the Arab Spring. They funded the crackdown on the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. The Sisi, the basically dictator of Egypt, engaged in. And they have attempted to crush the Muslim Brotherhood in many places, although they still support regimes where the Muslim Brotherhood is part of the government. Now, this all brings me to the murder of the journalist Khashoggi. Now, let's do a brief history of Khashoggi. Khashoggi has been part of the Saudi regime since he was young, since the late 1970s, early 1980s. He was very close to the king at that point. He was very close to the royal family. He comes from a wealthy family. He was very close to the Bin Laden family. And indeed, in the 1980s, he was one of the Saudi journalists covering the war in Afghanistan. And supporting, as all or most Muslim journalists and Arab journalists supported, the exploits of Bin Laden in Afghanistan. He was a supporter of Bin Laden through that, but so was the CIA, so was Ronald Reagan and the Bush administrations, so were many journalists in the Arab world, in the Muslim world. So Khashoggi was just part of that administration. He was a Muslim Brotherhood member at some point in his life and retained throughout his life sympathy with political Islam, with the idea of establishing Islam as the governing rule over the Middle East and ultimately the world. But the difference between him and maybe others was that he believed it could be done democratically, just like the Muslim Brotherhood, at least as a phase. He was a big supporter of Erdogan in Turkey, who came to power democratically, who has a pretense of democracy in the way he rules Turkey, but of course is an authoritarian, just not the kind of authoritarian like the royal family, because he gives a pretense to allowing secularization, a pretense of allowing free speech, a pretense of allowing critics, a pretense of democracy. So this journalist was a friend of the, what you would call in quotes, the more moderate Islamists, like Erdogan, like the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, and so on. Still the same goal, taking over the world and establishing Sharia law, but doing it in a more peaceful way and sustaining within it the appearances, the facade of, you know, call it democratic institutions, right? And that's what he was for. So Kikuchi is no advocate for freedom. He's no advocate for liberal democracy. He is no champion of the West. He's no champion of civilization. He is part of the problem in the Middle East. He's a huge supporter of Palestinian terrorist organizations, a huge supporter of those who support Hamas, and is, from what I can tell, was a supporter of Hamas. He was not a good guy. Now, I don't think that should matter. He was brutally murdered for what he says by a regime at least worse than he is. Not good. Neither was he good. But they're all bad. Right. And this is the thing, right? So the left is apoplectic. As if one of its own liberal crusaders who wanted to reform Saudi Arabia into a constitutional democracy, which he didn't. He wanted to convert it into a Turkey-like, or maybe he just wanted a different ruling prince. He didn't like MBS. But he still wanted Sharia. He wanted conservative, fundamentalist Islam to rule. At least everything I read about him suggests that. And so the left suddenly wants sanctions on Saudi Arabia, even though, again, when Obama was around, no sanctions, and they claim sanctions will work on Iran. Why would they work in Saudi Arabia? And then on top of that, you've got the right. The right says, who cares if they slaughtered him? He's just one of those crazy Islamists. Really? So we don't believe in free speech in the right? We don't believe in free speech in America anymore. If you hold wrong ideas, in this case, the clearly wrong ideas, you know, just butchering the guy is okay on foreign soil, not even on your own soil. But of course, the left's outrage is pathetic, and the right's excuses are pathetic because the fact is, Saudi Arabia deserves condemnation, not just because of this murder, also because of this murder, but because of their entire ideology, their entire governance, their entire structure. Everything that they represent, everything that they do, everything that they stand for should be criticized and condemned. We should not be trading with Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is the enemy. It's no different than Iran. And indeed, the solution to Saudi Arabia, the solution to this murder, but the solution more broadly, not to the murder shouldn't be the impetus. The impetus should be the fact that Saudi Arabia is an enemy state. Instead of obsessing about even North Korea or obsessing about China, we should take it seriously that Saudi Arabia, in addition to Iran, are enemy states. And if they don't behave, if they don't stop funding terrorism all over the world, if they don't stop supporting jihadism all over the world, if they don't stop supporting Sharia all over the world, if they don't stop funding the mosques and the madrasas all over the world, then they should be destroyed. Like the royal family should be wiped out. They're either going to stop funding people who want to kill us, or they should not survive. Now, that should have been done certainly in 9/11, when 15 of the 18 terrorists were Saudis. And what was the Bush response? Well, the only plane to be allowed to leave, I think it was either on 9/11 or 9/12, was a plane out of New York to Riyadh carrying the members of the Saudi royal family. And that is not a conspiracy theory. That is just a fact. The only plane to leave the United States, as far as I know, was a plane loaded up with Saudis from the embassy, primarily members of the royal family, but others who might be part of the Saudi intelligence services, who were shipped over to Saudi Arabia of fear of retaliation by Americans. Why were they allowed to leave? Because we have a special relationship with the Saudis. If you're worried about oil prices, then paratroop the 101st onto the oil fields of Saudi Arabia and take them. Maintain steady supply of oil and take out the regime. And, you know, replace them with somebody you can work with. That's the only thing, the only approach to Saudi Arabia. Sanctions is stupid, just like it's stupid with Iran. Condemnation is stupid. What? Give me a break. You have to give them an ultimatum. Either they stop, they can't murder people outside of Saudi Arabia, they can't murder people in the West, and they have to stop funding all these organizations, all these entities, or they get destroyed. That's my foreign policy. I don't play games with these idiots. I don't dance with them. And the idea, I mean, you guys know my attitude to Donald Trump, and I would rather not speak of him anymore. But, you know, how can you not respond? When he goes on television and says, well, we can't question, we can do, you know, yeah, we'll condemn this and we'll go after them, but you can't touch that deal, $100 million, as if it's, I don't know, corn, we're selling them, or computers, or something. We're selling them weapons. I don't care how many jobs are lost. Talk about the military industrial complex. Eisenhower's warning to us. This is the military industrial complex. This is the swamp. This is Donald Trump, a swamp animal. Not doing foreign policy, not dealing with what is in America's long-term self-interest, because some companies that produce weapons want to make sure they can sell them to our enemy. To our enemy. We shouldn't be selling Saudis weapons. We probably should be taking out every weapon they have on the ground. You never know who those weapons are going to fall into the hands of. And those Saudis should be penalized anyway for using their money to support other terrorism against us. So we are selling them weapons. I mean, we've been doing it for decades and decades. It's not just Trump. It's Obama. It's Bush. It's Clinton. It's Bush. It's Reagan. It's Carter. It's everybody. Everybody. Since basically FDR cut a deal with the Saudis during World War II, saying, we'll keep you in power. We'll supply you with weapons. We'll supply you with political protection. And in exchange, you give us oil. Talk about a deal with the devil, a devil. Ayn Rand said the military-industrial complex is a myth or worse, which was true when Ayn Rand talked about it. But I think Ayn Rand didn't anticipate the extent to which these companies became crony, these companies supported the perpetuation of wars that we refuse to win, like the war in Afghanistan and the war in Iraq. They perpetuate U.S. involvement all over the world. They advocate for it. They lobby for it. I can't even imagine what Ayn Rand's approach would be today to the idea that the United States that the United States would sell weapons to Saudi Arabia. Ayn Rand would... I am a moderate as compared to, I think, how Ayn Rand would respond to something like that. So, let me rephrase this. And she was right. It's not the industrial military complex that's really doing all this. What's doing it is pragmatism. What's doing it is altruism. What's doing it, the lack of any kind of self-interest among American politicians. It's the criminal, horrible, disgusting pragmatism of Trump and this administration. It's the horrible pragmatism of the left. It's the horrible pragmatism of the opposition. And it's the altruism, the idea that America can't stand for itself, that America can't defend itself, that America can't use its weapons and its military to actually defend its own interests. That is the real problem. It's the ideas that give power to the military-industrial complex. It's the ideas that made possible the lobbying and the cronyism that is America today. It's ideas. It's pragmatism. I mean, I've never heard, there has never been a more pragmatic, in the worst sense of the word, president than Donald Trump. Never. It worked. So who cares how I got there? What does work mean? Worked in what context? We've got jobs. So don't putz around with military contacts to the worst people on the planet. I fell in love with the brutal, murderous dictator of North Korea. So everything will be fine. That's foreign policy. That is American foreign policy today. Pragmatism to the nth degree. And the consequence is that nobody, I'm reading lots of articles, I'm reading everybody's opinion of, but nobody's saying it. Nobody's saying Saudi Arabia is an enemy. Saudi Arabia needs to be destroyed because it's an enemy of the United States. You know, Khashoggi is one more horrible thing that the Saudis have done. Now, I do want to mention one thing which I think is relevant here. And that is that the Saudis feel emboldened to do something like this. And I think the fact that they feel emboldened suggests that they believe the United States is weak, that the United States will not do anything, that the United States will not engage in any kind of punitive actions against them. And I think the reason they did that is the journalists are dying all over the world and the United States does nothing. The United States doesn't even condemn Putin when he kills journalists. Orban in Hungary, when he shuts down opposition newspapers and takes over every aspect of the media. The United States does not stand for freedom and liberty anymore in its foreign policy. The United States stands for what works. And MBS figures he's got a good relationship with Trump. Trump doesn't want to spoil that $100 billion deal. So he can get away with anything. So a lot of this is on America. A lot of this is on Trump. A lot of this is on this administration and past administration who have done nothing. Not just in Saudi Arabia, but all over the world. We let the rights of Americans be trampled on. We do not condemn authoritarianism, totalitarianism. We do not condemn murder. When people are murdered on British soil by Russian agents, we do almost nothing. When North Korean, when the brother of the savage, brutal dictator of North Korea gets killed in Malaysia with a radioactive poison, we do nothing. Ultimately, I mean, after all, Donald Trump fed in love with the guy. So we have no foreign policy. We will not stand up for our values. We have no standards. Now, in spite of the fact that the United States violates its own citizens' rights, it has always violated its own citizens' rights. There are degrees. You cannot equate the United States with Russia. You cannot equate the United States with Saudi Arabia. You cannot equate the United States with North Korea. Of course we have a moral leg to stand on. We are far, 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 far better than all those regimes, in spite of the fact that we are far from good. Just because the United States is not perfect does not mean that it cannot take the moral high ground, because it is much better than all of these. It protects rights to a much larger extent than all of these regimes. All right, so I'm going to end here. Sorry about the video. We at least, I think, got audio all set. Again, you've been listening to your own book show. Well, you'll get a completely different perspective on the news of the day, because here you'll actually hear the whole story. You'll actually get a lesson in history in addition to everything else. You'll get a sense of what is actually happening around the world. You'll get context. You won't just get sound bites. You won't just get sound bites. You will actually get analysis. So if you like the show, please subscribe to the YouTube channel. Please subscribe to the podcast. And of course, those of you who have not yet done so, you know, think about the value you get from the show. If you get value from it, I assume you do because you keep listening or watching. And go to Patreon or go to PayPal and subscribe. Subscribe financially. Financially support the show. If you get value, you know, $1 a month is all it takes. I mean, $500 a month would be great. You know, there's a lot to get to where I want to go. There's a lot more money that has to be raised. To get a, I'm hoping that you agree that this is a value. So at whatever level you can afford it, I really, really, really appreciate your support. Patreon.com/Yaron Brooks Show, PayPal.me/Yaron Brooks Show. Either one, Patreon is nice because it's kind of a monthly contribution. PayPal is nice if you just want to give one lump sum. It's perfect for that. Either way, the money goes to supporting my ability to continue doing these shows. All right. Thanks, everybody. Sorry for the technical glitch. I will talk to you all soon. Have a great of the rest of the weekend. Bye, everybody. Mm-hmm.